This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, protesters tell Attorney General Eric Holder that the U.S. mass Black incarceration system must be dismantled. Every U.S. president since Bill Clinton has ignored laws requiring them to keep track of police misconduct. And President Obama prepares to commit new crimes in Syria and Iraq. But first, a host of organizations converged on the U.S. Justice Department in Washington, D.C. to demand fundamental changes in the way the criminal justice system treats Black Americans. Marsha Coleman Adebayo of the No Fear Coalition was one of the chief organizers. The demands were contained in a letter addressed to Attorney General Eric Holder.
The day of the demonstration, the Inspector General came out to meet us, and he said that instead of us going in, they would prefer to have someone from Mr. Holder's office come out to me and that I could present the demands to a representative of the Attorney General's office. So they came out at 4:30, and we had maybe 200 to 300 people at the rally at that point. And so literally we were able to present our demands in front of about 300 people and about 50 to 60 members of the press. So I'm not sure what they're thinking, because in my mind, it clearly would have been better for them if they had allowed two or three of us just to go to the office and privately deliver the letter. But because they were so fearful, or maybe just didn't want us to come into their building, they ended up having the demands presented in front of almost 300 people, and on top of it, media. So what we decided to do, or what I decided to do, is to literally read the demands in front of the news media to this person, so that now the whole country knows about. Actually, it's 9 demands. The first demand, however, deals with the immediate arrest and persecution of the police officer who executed Michael Brown. And so that was the first demand that we made. The second demand is we're asking for legislation to be introduced which will require life sentences for policemen who murder unarmed boys and men. The third demand is strong disciplinary sanctions against excessive use of force by police. And the fourth demand is the ending of mass incarceration of boys and men of color, and to release those jailed for minor crimes. And I think if I had to rework that sentence now, it would have been nonviolent crimes as opposed to minor crimes. But when Eric Holder became the Attorney General, he said that one of his goals was to release Black, Brown men and boys in prison who were there for nonviolent crimes. And now we're 6 years into the administration. I think they're sort of still bragging about the 100 Black men that they released, because I think they were in jail for very minor offenses, like having, you know, like a gram or something of marijuana on them, and they received these ridiculous prison sentences. So that's a demand. But one of the things that I'd like to say about this particular demand is that it's not enough to end incarceration for African American and brown and boys and men who have been charged and convicted under racial laws. It's also important that once they come out of prison, that the government provides some kind of reparations to them so that they can get their lives back. You know, whether that's, you know, free college tuition or job training or just cash money for violating their human rights and putting them in prison. So it's not enough just for them to release them. They also have to, I think there has to be some kind of reparations paid to these people. And then I think there's a question of timing. These men, every single minute, second that they stay in prison, these men are risking their lives in prison. So it's not a question of ending mass incarceration. It's also releasing the Black boys and men who are in prison right now immediately, and then giving them some kind of reparations so that they can get their lives somewhat back together.
Taken together, these demands would represent a reversal of policy for a government that for the last 45 years has maintained a national policy of mass black incarceration.
Right. And, you know, I use mass incarceration only because, you know, we have a coalition and we have to use words that are sort of in currency right now. But I really, from my perspective, I think we're looking at ethnic cleansing. And I think any other country, if you're looking at the country from the inside out, you'd see that this is a violation of the UN provisions on ethnic cleansing. And from an environmental science perspective, this is also almost a definition, the definition of ethnic cleansing. When you take males of any species out of the society in the most productive, reproductive years of their life, what you're trying to do, of course, is to reduce the population of that species. In the case of our community, what the mass incarceration or ethnic cleansing program policies of the United States government has been is to target males between the ages of, say, 15 to 30, get them out of the population so that they cannot reproduce. And so that, and then in fact, when they're reintroduced into the society, you know, they're traumatized, they're, you know, they have all kinds of anxiety, depression. It's just a recipe for basically destroying a community. And in the environmental science community, you know, when we're looking at various species, we're constantly talking about how do you usually increase certain populations. But if we're trying to decrease populations, we do exactly what the United States government has done with African American men. We reduce the availability of young, productive males in a society, and that's called ethnic cleansing, and that's what this country is doing with African Americans in prisons.
One of your demands is that there be a recall of all the military equipment that's been given to cities and state police departments. That's demilitarization of the police forces. And polls have shown that majorities of Americans agree with that. However, the cop who shot Michael Brown was not wearing military gear. Is it the military gear or the actual relationship between the police and the black community that's really the problem?
I think it's both. I mean, I think we have to demand the removal of this Fallujah-type military apparatus that is either in the community right now or, you know, located behind closed doors somewhere, because the level of militarism and the level of equipment that we saw released in Ferguson, I think for most Americans, was almost unbelievable, almost unbelievable. I think my understanding is that the Department of Defense had provided, I think it was like $3 billion of equipment, initially free to all these, you know, local jurisdictions. But of course, this equipment is not going to remain free because you need to repair the equipment, you need to replace parts. When once you get used to using a certain type of equipment, when it eventually breaks down, you buy another one. So there are hidden costs in this quote-unquote free equipment from the Department of Defense, but also giving all this quote-unquote free equipment to these municipalities freed up the Department of Defense to buy new toys that they can use to occupy various countries of under American domain. So the intent is financial as well as cultural, just to provide a show of force, which, of course, they had hoped would back down the citizens of Ferguson. In fact, what we really see in Ferguson are men and women standing in front of tanks and showing the most unbelievable courage that I think we've seen in a very long time, defying the tanks, throwing their hands up, not in surrender, but in revolt. So Ferguson becomes this landmark struggle in our community that I think is going to find its place, and that's what I argue in the Black Agenda Report piece, that I think it's going to find its place alongside Selma and Montgomery and these other incredible historic moments in American history. So I think it's both. And I think it's pretty clear as well that in Ferguson, becoming a police officer is basically a second career for someone who's in the Ku Klux Klan. So a lot of these people, I think, in Ferguson and these surrounding areas have decided, you know, why join the Klan when I'm going to be arrested, you know, as a citizen, when I can kill black folks and have a badge on my chest and receive sovereign immunity for murdering these people. Much smarter than being in the Klan, quite frankly. And when we see that Officer Darren Wilson has not even been charged with a crime yet, unless it happened this morning, has not been arrested, at this point, they're waiting for basically a kangaroo court grand jury to come in, and no one really expects them to come back and indict him. But we certainly hope that happens. But when you consider that the grand jury is composed of the same whites who are demonstrating on the street and calling Darren Wilson a hero, I think there's some concerns that they're going to come back and indict him in a grand jury. So what I'm saying is that, yeah, we need everything. We need a complete change of culture. We need these police officers to understand there will be accountability if they shoot unarmed men, such as life sentences without parole. We need strong disciplinary sanctions against excessive force. We also need to get the military equipment and all the guns and the tanks and the tear gas, which is illegal under international law. We need to get all of it out of our community. In fact, we need to get the police, as they are currently constituted, out of our community. So we're calling for a complete change of how we see our community, but particularly I think what became very clear in Ferguson is that the police force is an occupying force in our community, and we must call for all occupations to be removed from the black community.
Clearly, in Ferguson, with its almost all white police force and an overwhelmingly white city government in a city that's two-thirds black, there is a classic racial problem there. But in nearby St. Louis, which at least until very recently was a majority black city, which has had a black mayor, which has had a black police chief, in fact, that black police chief is now going to be head of the state police. Still, these kinds of extrajudicial killings of blacks occur, just as they do in every black city. So is the solution to elect more black elected officials and hire more black police officers and somehow think that that's going to change the nature of the police occupation?
Right. I mean, I think one of the things that we learned from the election of Barack Obama, hopefully one of the lessons that we learned from his tenure as president, is that we have to really focus on the politics and we have to really focus on the commitments to justice as opposed to solely the color of someone's skin or the gender, for example, in the presumptive, you know, campaign of Hillary Clinton. But, you know, one of the things that I argued, I think, in the Black Agenda Report is that institutions change people. People very rarely change institutions. And so that when black police officers join a police force, whether it's black or white, the culture of the police force is the dominant feature of that institution. And unless those police officers, you know, are prepared to be fired immediately, they have to get with the program. In order to get past the personnel requirements and in order to get past the yearly or bi-yearly performance evaluations, the supervisors critiquing of their skills, these officers basically cannot function outside of the institution that they belong to. So the answer to your question is no. I don't think it really matters whether you're black or white or whatever you are if you're inside of that particular culture, because the culture itself becomes the predominant theme of the activities that take place within that institution. So what we're arguing here in terms of our demands, first of all, is that we see the police force again as an occupying force. So whether it's a black occupying force or white occupying force, as it's currently constituted, we don't think there's a place for that kind of force to be inside of our community. And so what we're arguing for at this point is to have a citizens committee, people within the community who can provide the kind of structure we need to be able to take care of, to protect and serve. Because what we have to ask in all situations, particularly with police forces, is who are they protecting and who are they serving? And clearly the occupying forces inside of our communities are not protecting the people and they're not serving the people. They're occupying the people. And so whether they're black or they're white, it would seem to me, and I think to my colleagues, is quite irrelevant. They're occupiers, and that's the bottom line.
Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo of the No Fear Coalition. She's also an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report. Omali Yeshetela of the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations journeyed to Ferguson, Missouri last week. We asked Yeshetela what he learned.
Well, one thing I've learned is that the struggle and consciousness of the people in Ferguson is very deep. It is something that only occurs when movements develop long enough for them to take hold. And that's something that's happened in Ferguson. There have been rebellions prior to now in various places, and while the rebellions have been going on, we've seen the same kind of collective consciousness occur. But Ferguson has allowed it to really sink in and be very deep. And it's interesting how it influences the behavior, the generosity of just ordinary African people here on the streets and in the supermarkets and every place you go. So that's one thing, that the depth of this whole collective consciousness is very significant. The other thing about Ferguson that's important, I believe, is the absence of a kind of working class movement, a movement led by African working class or revolutionaries. There's a form of class warfare that is, to me, very obvious happening here in Ferguson, where the especially young African and militant workers, just ordinary people, there's an ongoing effort to smother the resistance, to smother the demands that they would be trying to come up with. And of course, at the funeral of Mike Brown, it was something to behold how a very conscious effort was made by, I think, every sellout in the country is concentrated in Ferguson, or was concentrated in Ferguson at one time or another. And the struggle there at the funeral was made manifest as the people were driven to a real kind of religious frenzy. We heard some militant sellout-ism in the form, particularly of Al Sharpton, who had a real militant presentation with the line being simply, turn it over to God and vote. But it was militantly vote and militantly turn it over to God. I mean, I think those are some of the things. And then I think a most important thing is the militarization of this community. And I don't mean the obvious kinds of machinery, weaponry that we saw earlier on in the struggle in Ferguson. I mean the police and every kind of police organization is present here in Ferguson. So there's this image being given to the world through the collaboration of ruling class media that somehow things are calming down and people are not being as militant and insistent in their demands, while on the other hand, they do not talk about how ubiquitous the presence of various arms of the state is in Ferguson.
Yes, in some ways it seems that some of those folks who went to that church are arms of the state, like firemen sent to tamp down the people's fervor.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're looking at. We're looking at a two-pronged attack on the people. One is obvious military organization, and the other, sometimes with their collars on backwards and sometimes not, who dare to pacify the people, to tamp down any kind of militancy and resistance that might be coming from the people. They want it to go away. But if it won't go away, what they want it to do is to be channeled to God, to heaven, and to the vote, someplace respectable and someplace where it can be contained and not get out of hand.
Yes, many people found Ferguson amazing in that the people not only stood up, but refused to stand down.
Well, that is the extraordinary thing, and that's the thing that's given the ruling class in this country real concern, because this thing has been going on since August 9th, and it's not over. And one big problem, as I said, that they have is trying to find a way to channel it, to sap the people's energies with nonsense or anything but the kind of revolutionary outbreak that we've seen happen in this city. And so almost every day there's a demonstration happening someplace, spontaneous demonstration. And they aren't all revolutionary or anything like that, but they are demonstrations, and they represent the fact that people are determined to change something. And even though that's not clearly understood what the change is that they're looking for, people definitely want change. And I've seen just sometimes groups from a single family just standing on the street with their signs. Groups of people just come out with their signs. They're not a part of any kind of organization, and perhaps don't even intend to be a part of an organization, but they're there. So it is pretty deep here in Ferguson, and it's really a remarkable thing to observe. But I think that Ferguson is simply first blood, that the brothers and sisters in this city, and especially young brothers and sisters who are on the end of a lot of condemnation from platforms and pulpits and things like that, because they want to characterize these young brothers and sisters as being violent, when it's violence that brought them into motion in the first place. And it is their actions that's given attention to all of these newly arrived leaders in this city. Without that action by those people, they wouldn't even be here, and they wouldn't even have any kind of media attention. So it's been incredible, and these young people stood up, and not only did they stand up, but they have, as you said, refused to stand down. The fact that they held on for so long is what helped to expose the conditions of African people in this country to the world. Because as you and I know, Ferguson is not new. It is not unusual. Mike Brown's death is not peculiar. It is something that's happening in this country on a daily basis. But the resistance here, that's the thing that makes it outstanding and makes Ferguson outstanding. And the fact that it refuses to go away. And because of that, now you have all the media here who've shown the tanks in the streets, who've shown the police snipers, who've shown the National Guards, and things like this. But again, that's something that's not peculiar to Ferguson. They're all over this country, and we've seen them come out in the same fashion in other places in the country that they've shown themselves here in Ferguson. And those young people, their tenacity, their unwillingness to retreat is what has forced recognition of this reality upon the world. This reality of the conditions of African people, again, has been exposed as a consequence of the tenacity of the young people who have stood up here in Ferguson.
Regarding the people of Ferguson's desire for change, the governor of Missouri has named a black man who used to be the police chief in St. Louis as head of the state's police.
Well, that's really interesting, because I was anticipating something like this. In fact, I'm really astonished by this. As I said, the police are everywhere. You know, one person who came from our movement from Chicago, simply out one night Friday and was arrested off the street, just picked up. I've seen people just picked up. They can't, they give you this place, you can march around the circle. And if you stop marching, then you are immediately and automatically arrested. People thrown in jail, kept for 24 hours and then released as a part of the process to try to stop this thing from happening. So, yeah. I'm not surprised that the governor has done that. It's very clear when they've trotted out Ron Johnson that there was going to be an attempt to give the repression of the state a black face, or to give it a huggy, I love every my brothers and sisters kind of face, and they did that. And you and I are familiar with how people in Egypt got duped by a similar ploy, when the people who were in constant contact with the police in Egypt thought that they were the real problem and embraced the army. And then, of course, they see where they are now in terms of how the army has suppressed all the rights of the people. And that was Ron Johnson's role. So now we are to understand that the Ferguson Police Department was the bad guys. And because it's majority white, and now with a Negro captain out in the street shaking hands, speaking like a preacher, loving all the black people, et cetera, things are going to be better. But the thing is that I don't know how many people have bought into that, but I do know that what's going to make a determination is not whoever heads up the State Department, what its color is. It's going to be how things are happening on the ground, where young people are tired. Young Africans are tired of being on the end of every attack by the police, being killed in the streets, and being just pushed nearly out of existence unless they stand up. So I recognized that move, and I saw that the governor had made that move, but it won't work. I'm convinced of that.
You say that the movement is not over in Ferguson, but what about the movement's effect on the rest of the country and the world? What's the significance here for the future?
Well, I think that's one of the things that I think makes Ferguson significant. If it was just something that was going to impact Ferguson, this struggle, and I'm not ready to call it a movement as such yet. It hasn't achieved a certain kind of coherence here, but it will. But if it were just confined to Ferguson, then it wouldn't be that significant. It really wouldn't. But I think what Ferguson has done has given permission and energy, and it boosted the morale of African people throughout this country. The heroism of black people in Ferguson, I think, is something that sounded as a certain kind of call to arms. And we've seen the response to that. Even the Eric Garner thing that happened in New York with Al Sharpton marching in front of it, I think the turnout there is a consequence, a response to what's happened in Ferguson. Throughout this country, black people are marching, having demonstrations in solidarity with Ferguson. And I think what we're going to see is Ferguson repeating itself all over the country. One of the things that caught my attention, and I think the attention of a lot of people, when Mike Brown was gunned down on August 9th here in Ferguson, you didn't hear people singing "We Shall Overcome" and "The Rotten Apple in the Barrel." The people on the ground, Mike Brown's contemporaries, his homies, were saying, "Kill the police." That was the response, "Kill the police." And that made the media. And I think that was one of the things that startled the ruling class in this country. And I think that was one of the things that alerted black people that something different is happening in Ferguson. And so I think the consequences of Ferguson, it will continue to reverberate, not only with black people, but the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, for example, offered a salute to black people in Ferguson, recognizing today, as it was recognized in the 60s, that it's going to be the black movement in this country that will bring the empire down. We saw the Russian parliament, debate in the Russian parliament, where one parliamentarian was calling for sending peacekeepers into this country to look at the conditions of African people. ALBA, the Alliance of Caribbean and Latin American Countries, also spoke out in solidarity with Africans and in condemnation of how the United States government is treating our people, Iran. So this is happening all around the world. People are recognizing the significance of this. And people who, some of whom countries have their own beefs with the United States, that walks around the world or prances around the world or shoot its way around the world, claiming that it's doing so in the name of democracy and freedom. And then now black people who have a history of several hundred year history of being oppressed in this country, standing up, giving evidence to the world that that oppression continues to this day in the 21st century. So I think that there's going to continue to be reverberations around the country and around the world from Ferguson. Again, I believe Ferguson is first blood in the reemergence of the liberation movement in this country. I think Ferguson is significant because it helps to collectivize the consciousness of black people for resistance. And that's been something that's not been high on the agenda for a long time, even when people have gone into places like Jenna around Louisiana or even around Trayvon Martin, where we saw certain kinds of things happening. Ferguson reverberates differently. And I think it's precisely because the resistance in Ferguson was so sharp and lasted so long that it was able to capture the imagination and then contribute again to a radical collective consciousness of black people in this country.
Omali Yeshitela, chairman of the Black is Back Coalition. Black is Back plans a national march on the White House on November 1st. Erica Totten is a young black activist from Washington, D.C., who's been going back and forth to Ferguson. Totten says black people are always met with force when they demand justice. In that regard, Ferguson was nothing special.
It wasn't the first time it happened. It happened in Brooklyn last year for the death of Kamani Gray, but that wasn't in the media. But there were tanks rolling through Brooklyn, just like there were in Ferguson. So to be able to see it, especially from a peaceful protest, that it was peaceful, to be met with, actually in the beginning, they were met with dogs and guns before the media even started to cover anything. And, you know, the mass media started covering things maybe about 5 days later. But, you know, being connected with social media and following people that were on the ground there and seeing videos and of the police attacks and that was happening daily, I knew that this is the norm. This is what happens. And, you know, being a history buff,
it definitely reminded me of times in the Civil Rights Movement, but also Tulsa, Oklahoma, when black people were bombed from the air. So everything started to click. Also in seeing the psychological violence that goes with white supremacy, seeing it present day, clear as day, back to back, including just talking to the people of Ferguson, that everybody had a story with the police. Everybody had a problem with the police harassing them. And, you know, Michael Brown's body being left out to bleed out in the street for 4 hours, another example of psychological violence. So, yeah, it all clicked for me in realizing that this is the MO. This is what happened. And I think what's so special about Ferguson, one, is not far from St. Louis. And a lot of people that are in St. Louis know somebody in Ferguson or have family in Ferguson. And because tensions had been so high with being terrorized by police, that it was bound to happen. And when it did happen, in the way that it did, so publicly and so blatant, of Michael Brown having his hands up and still being shot in broad daylight with witnesses all around, something blew up in the people, and especially in the young people there, that they wanted to fight and they want justice and they're going to make some noise. And I completely understood what, you know, they had the so-called looters and rioters and things like that. But talking to the people on the ground, the message is clear that if you don't care about our lives, we don't care about your property. And in this capitalistic society, we got to break stuff. We got to burn stuff down. We got to burn property down for you to pay attention and for you to hear us. And I completely understand.
By going to Ferguson, you joined those folks that some people are calling outside agitators.
Desiree X spoke about that yesterday. And he is a conscious hip-hop artist that went down there with David Banner and was speaking to a lot of the young men there, and they were just in a group. Now, mind you, our rights changed daily when we were there. So we could protest, but you had to walk. You had to keep moving. You can protest, but you can't be in groups. And so all these different things, they changed day to day. Broad daylight, even well before the curfew, they had stopped and they were speaking as Jasiri tells it. And all of a sudden they were surrounded by 15 or so cops, and the cops arrested two of the men that were there. And it's interesting because they could have arrested Jasiri and David Banner, but they of course were outsiders. So it's like they're targeting the people that are there, their local people, because they can't go home. This is their home. So outside people can, as they say, can leave. But when he went up to Johnson and said, why did you do this? He said, I don't have to talk to you. You know, you're not from here. And so it's a completely different image of the you see on TV.
So what you're saying is the police were consciously and deliberately trying to pacify the residents of Ferguson.
Absolutely. And that's again, a part of that psychological violence.
What was your impression of the level of organization that existed within Ferguson?
When I got there, it was before the other organizations were there doing trainings and workshops like they're doing now, which I'm really, really proud of that other organizations were there. Because when I was there, there were young people there that were just trying to figure it out. They knew something needed to be done. They knew that, you know, the protesters were out there all the time. So they needed to be fed. They needed to have water. They needed to have, you know, wounds bandaged. They needed to be taught about creating anti-tear gas spray, because many of them that were on the front line didn't know about that, didn't have that knowledge. So when we came there, we already knew that that was one of the things that we were going to do. We were going to make sure that we made anti-tear gas spray bottles and give them to those brothers and sisters that were out there on the front line. And so it would be, you know, many nights where we would be running, where we see the cloud of tear gas coming, and we would try to spray people's shirts that didn't even have, you know, bandanas or anything over their face, but if they're going to use their shirts, to breathe in through that spray. And so with that, there were other people that, so we were organizing in different areas, but without one main organization. But one of the organizations that we connected with was the Organization for Black Struggle. That's where we were at, St. Mark's Church. That got raided by the police, by the way. Supplies taken, and actually there were some people on the ground there that suspected that they bugged the church because that's where some of us were meeting. So supplies taken, again, just psychological violence, terrorizing, because how do you go into a church and take supplies? I mean, first aid kits, water, just the basics that we were taking people to this safe space to get away from the gas because there were kids out there. You know, there were kids out there that were just trying to get home when they started gassing us. We saw a group of kids that were just choking and could hardly breathe. And they said that they were just coming home. They weren't even out there trying to protest. They were just trying to get home and ended up getting caught up in that. So we put them in our truck and were, you know, trying to find a way to get out through the different neighborhoods because it's a neighborhood. It's a nice neighborhood. People try to make Ferguson look like it's the hood, but it's homes on each side of West Florida Farm, tree-lined streets. And that's why I say this could easily happen. This could be Waldorf, Maryland. This could be Clinton, Maryland. It could be our city. And getting those kids and trying to get them out, we ran into more tear gas. So it filled up our car. It was methodical the way that they did it to try to push people into a certain direction. And it was terror because on that last Monday, it seemed like they pulled out all the stops when it came to that tear gas and shooting, that they were actually going through neighborhoods shooting at people, shooting tear gas at people, shooting rubber bullets and spark bombs and concussion bombs and like all of that. And it was just like they really are terrorizing people because it's not just about dispersing the crowd. You're now going into neighborhoods and shooting people trying to get away.
We were given the impression that the police were just trying to make a peace or calm zone.
That is a lie. That is a lie. And I've been telling people that ever since I got back here. Because the problem with that is if you're dispersing a crowd, there's no reason for you to be rolling up and down an empty street looking at people trying to get away and still shooting at them. And what they try to do with the media is they keep trying to show that same looting video over and over to try to get people to understand why the police presence is so high. And when I was there, there was no looting. None.
From your observations, do you think that these events in Ferguson will leave behind, in Ferguson, real structures of militant resistance?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because this is what I've seen, too. There is an age gap, a generation gap, between the people that are fighting and the people that are older and that just want things to go back to quote-unquote normal, in which we know what normal was Michael Brown getting shot and police harassing residents. So there are young people that have come together. All of the young people came together with Organization for Black Struggle and an organization called MORE and developed Hands Up United, so handsupunited.org. And those are the young people, the young leaders there, that want to fight and that want to make noise and want to fight for justice. And they have that clear list of demands. So if anybody wants to support the real movement down there and support those young people, because just in our history, it's always been young people that were rising up and making noise and protesting. And so handsupunited.org is a website to go to support those people. And they need mental health care professionals. They need attorneys. They need support. They need people to come down there and support these men and young women in their efforts because they are not going to go quiet and they're going to continue to make noise. As an organizer in D.C., is making sure that we keep a sustained movement going. So if someone is going down there as an attorney or a mental health care professional or a health care professional, and you go down there and you donate that time, we support that. There are safe houses that we have there where people are able to stay for free, that we can get them connected to people down there that are actually serving. And so when we send one person down there, that gives somebody else a chance to get a break, to pause for a second and refuel, and then keep the movement going. Because it has to be a sustained effort. We don't want people getting burnt out. So we need to have a network of people that have specific skills that can go down and donate that time for the people that have been there since day one that are exhausted. And actually during the shooting of Kajime Powell, a few miles away from Ferguson, that was a spirit crusher. And that's what I talk about with that psychological violence. When people called me when that happened, that lived right down the street, they called me saying, "Yo, Erica, they're exterminating folks. We right down here protesting about the killing of a young black man, and they kill another one right down the street." And it broke people's spirits. It broke people's spirits because they're saying, this is what they do. This is what they do to us.
Overall, do you think the Ferguson experience has been a cathartic moment for grassroots black struggle?
Oh, yes. I think it was a strong wake-up call, too, that we really have to be about this work because we have been silent and we haven't been working together. There's so many organizations that other people don't even know about. There has to be a network that gets everybody together, that egos are put to the side, and it's about the work. And whatever area it is that you specialize or that you have expertise, then that's your lane that you stay in, and you're pushing the work. You're not pushing your name out there. You're not pushing any other agendas, that you are really about the work. Because when you go down to Ferguson, you can tell the people that are really there about the work, and you can tell the people that are trying to exploit this for something else. And you're going to get called out. You're going to get called out, and your name is going to be dragged on Twitter because people are going to know that you're not really there about the work.
Erica Totten, speaking from Washington. How many blacks are shot down without justification each year by U.S. cops? Well, we really don't know, because Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama have all refused to comply with the law that requires them to keep data on police misconduct. Bar Managing Editor Bruce Dixon has this commentary.
We're all supposed to be impressed with the fact that Attorney General Eric Holder parachuted into Ferguson, Missouri the other day to wrap his arms around the local top black cop and get briefed on the pending federal investigation into the police killing of Michael Brown. But maybe we shouldn't be. For the last 20 years, since 1994, the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act obligates the Department of Justice to collect statistics on the extent of brutality and excessive force used by police officers and to make those findings available to the public. 20 years down the road, no such stats exist because the Departments of Justice under the Clinton, the Bush, and the Obama administration have all simply ignored the law and refused to even try to gather the information. Let me say this again. The Clinton Justice Department defied the law and refused to gather national stats on police misconduct. The Bush Justice Department thumbed its nose at the law and also refused to gather national stats on police misconduct. And now, today, for the last 5 years, the first black attorney general, who sometimes even utters the phrase mass incarceration, which he recently discovered, selected by the first black president, who says if he had a son, his son could be Trayvon Martin. Eric Holder and Barack Obama have likewise shown no interest whatsoever in fulfilling their legal duty when it comes to assembling a national database on police misconduct. This should not surprise the president's apologists, who will surely counsel us that he has to be president of all the people, including the police. Everybody knows black and brown people are the disproportionate targets of police violence, so enforcing laws which particularly benefit black and brown communities are something we must not expect. Perhaps after the president leaves office, they'll tell us, he'll speak out more forcefully on this. Maybe the My Brother's Keeper initiative can get some charitable dollars from corporations to organizations like Sharpton's National Action Network or PUSH, or the Urban League, to help more of our young boys to pull their pants up so they won't get beat down. Let's get real. The Republicans haven't stopped Obama and Holder from doing this. They stopped themselves. Like every cop on the beat, the Obama administration chooses which laws to enforce, which ones to bend and in what direction, and which ones to ignore. Obama's DOJ has resurrected the century-old Espionage Act, not to prosecute spies, but to threaten and imprison whistleblowers who tell the truth to reporters, and to imprison journalists themselves if they do not reveal their sources, with decades in prison, like Chelsea Manning, and all on so-called secret evidence. So when you think about it, it's entirely logical that a president and an attorney general who place such a high priority on protecting their torturers, their bankster friends, and the official wrongdoers of past and future administrations should want to protect the police from scrutiny as well. It's time to shed some illusions, not just about this president, but about the whole political class that claims he or any president can be held accountable. Barack Obama and his Justice Department are no more interested in justice than the administrations of 10 presidents before him. And uncritical black and brown support has made this president less accountable to black and brown people than any in living memory.
Bar Managing Editor Bruce Dixon, what kind of difference have the events in Ferguson made in black politics? Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, has this report for Prison Radio.
As the body of Michael Mike Brown is consigned to the earth, network newscasters and broadcasters are packing their gear, canceling their hotel rooms, and setting their sights on new wonders, new images, and new stories. That the tragic saga in Ferguson struck national news desks is both rare and unprecedented, given the length and depth of the story. But to reporters, stories come and stories go. And the Brown story is going. Part of the reason is the incessant media chorus for the expulsion of so-called outside agitators, seen as the violence-prone troublemakers coming on the scene. Once gone, tension drained away like an unwanted migraine. And tension, in the words of Martin Luther King Jr., creative tension is the stuff that animates protests and helps fuel movements. It is the job of the managerial class of lawyers, preachers, and politicians to reduce tensions, to de-radicalize movements, to make them manageable. And once they become manageable, they lose their mass base, and with it, its social power. For the masses know the essential nature of the police, for they see them and gauge them daily. They know them as violent, vicious, and venal government officials, and they are hungry, anxious to oppose them. Movements are a lot like volcanoes, which appear dormant or sleeping. Unseen or underground forces churning, boiling, crashing like waves against a hidden shore. Until one day, usually a day none had foreseen, it erupts, splashing its red molten rage over miles, changing everything. That's what movements do and what they are. If hot enough, they can change everything. Everything. But political, media, and state forces don't want change. They want continuity, for therein lies both their profits and their power. And who wants to lose either of those things? Therefore, the tragedy of Ferguson will be stuffed back into the pillow of forgetfulness. Until next time.
President Obama is preparing to do something horrifically dangerous in Syria and Iraq. The rise of ISIS has crippled the empire's decades-old strategy of deploying Islamic fundamentalist fighters to do its dirty work in the Arab and Muslim world. ISIS, the Frankenstein birthed in the cauldron of America's quest for regime change in Syria, has turned on its U.S., Saudi, Qatari, and Turkish masters to establish its own caliphate, to which thousands of other Islamic fighters are flocking. Even U.S. corporate media now acknowledge that the so-called moderate Syrian rebels that Obama wants to shovel $500 million at are virtually non-existent. They were always a mirage, creatures of Western propaganda. The Islamists were the only force that could challenge the Syrian army on the battlefield, and now that they are rallying to ISIS, or running away, Obama does not know which way to turn. Certainly, the U.S. can bomb ISIS positions in Syria and is already making preparations to do so, but that is not the war Obama wanted to fight. 3 years ago, when Obama launched his dirty war against Syria, the plan was for Muslim jihadists to shed their blood to overthrow President Assad. Once the filthy deed was done, the jihadists were expected to allow NATO and the corrupt kings of the Arabian Peninsula to pick the next rulers of Syria. The CIA was playing Lawrence of Arabia, using the jihadists as cannon fodder to be set aside when it came time to split up the spoils. Such was also the plan in Libya, where NATO and the same gang of Royal Arabian Thieves funded and armed the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi. The Libyan jihadists have also failed to cooperate with the empire's scheme. The global jihadist network that the Americans and Saudis created in the 1980s has declared its independence, and Washington has nothing to replace them. American boots on the ground are unacceptable to both the people of the region and the U.S. public. Obama and his minions say the U.S. and its allies will crush ISIS, but that will be like smothering one's own child in its crib and would remove all hope of the U.S. achieving its strategic goal of regime change in Syria. If Obama was serious about wanting to crush ISIS, the best and most logical ally would be Syrian President Assad, whose army has so far prevailed against every flavor of jihadist the U.S. has been able to throw at it, including ISIS in its previous incarnations. Nobody wants ISIS defeated more than Syria and its soldiers, more of whom have died in this U.S.-engineered war than any other group, civilian or rebels. If Obama was serious about crushing ISIS, he would coordinate his moves with the Syrian military. But he's lying, just as the Bush administration lied to make the American people believe that Saddam Hussein was responsible for 9/11. The U.S. goal was not to avenge 9/11, but to invade Iraq. In the same way, Obama is compelled to respond to the defection of ISIS from Western control, but his goal remains to overthrow President Assad, and he will tell any lie or combinations of lies to somehow turn U.S. bombs on the Syrian government under the guise of fighting ISIS. You can bet that the CIA is burning the midnight oil, seeking a pretext to turn this strategic U.S. defeat into an excuse to directly attack Syria. And that's what makes this moment so dangerous. And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.